Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Eight Bears, Mythic Past and Imperiled Future, by Gloria Dickey, read by Cassidy Brown. Preface. In the summer of 2013, I moved into a small second-story condo in downtown Boulder, Colorado, a college town bordering the foothills of the Rocky Mountains. I was about to start a master's program in environmental journalism at the University of Colorado Boulder, and the city seemed like a fitting place for this field of study. Boulder, gently sloping toward the mountains, is located on the fractious edge of wilderness. It's the kind of place where people can hike up one of the five Flatirons, unique geological formations that resemble their name, before dawn and still make it to the office before the workday begins. Later, I'd learn that scientists have a jargony name for this, the Wildland-Urban Interface, the WUI, pronounced WUI, presents all sorts of challenges to people and critters alike. Houses built in this zone are at greater risk of burning down during ferocious wildfires. Erosion and then flooding often follow, washing over charred soil and eating up riverbanks. And humans and wildlife fight for territory in the WUI. Less than a mile separates some of Boulder's most extravagant homes from the black bears and mountain lions prowling the pine forest above town. When I moved there, bears were frequent visitors. They could often be found eating apples in the North Boulder neighborhood, once a rambling orchard, and around University Hill, where hundreds of students lived in fraternity and sorority houses bordering the Flatirons. Dumpsters spilled their fermenting guts into alleys, drawing bears down from the mountains. I'd come to Boulder from Canada, a place that the country's founders had once considered naming Ursulaia, meaning place of bears, for its abundant Bruins. Except I'd grown up in southwestern Ontario, one of the most populated areas of the country, where humans had exterminated anything bigger than a white-tailed deer. There were black bears all around me, in the cottage country of northern Ontario and over the border in Michigan and New York State. But I was stranded in a bear desert. For a child obsessed with wild creatures, it was a tough break. Squirrels were the height of charismatic megafauna. The only chance I had to see a bear was during childhood trips to visit my grandparents, who lived in Calgary, Alberta, not far from Banff. But when we visited the Rockies, my parents kept me on a leash, humiliating, for fear that I would run ahead on the trail and be mauled by a grizzly. It was a bleak and tame existence. Boulder promised to be different. I eagerly followed news of animal sightings in the Daily Camera, the local paper. There was the bear sleeping in the tree on campus, the mountain lion trading glares with a house cat, the bobcat roaming through backyards. Nearly every week that fall there was an article about a black bear wandering into town. Colorado Parks and Wildlife, the state agency tasked with managing wild animals, moved the bears away from Boulder. Often they drove them as far as the Wyoming border, but a few months would pass and I'd read that a relocated bear had returned to town. Living so close to wild animals wasn't nearly as thrilling as I'd expected. Boulder was no utopia for bears. Colorado officials were operating under a two-strike policy. If they caught a nuisance bear repeating so-called bad behavior, they killed it. One early September day, a male black bear was dozing in the tall oak trees near Boulder's Columbia Cemetery. It wasn't the first time. A green ear tag drew attention to the bear's previous urban rendezvous. At 3 p.m., nearby Flatirons Elementary School went into lockdown. No student was allowed to leave the building with the bear hanging around. Wildlife officials were called. After 3 hours of waiting to see if the bear would return to the mountains of his own volition, officers shot and killed the animal. Parents of the pupils at Flatirons weren't happy. Their children were heartbroken to learn of the slumbering animal's fate. 3 days later, another especially large black bear, 590 pounds, was killed outside the elementary school. He, too, was known to wildlife wardens. A necropsy revealed that the fat bear's stomach was filled with two steaks, still in their wrappers, pasta, potatoes, eggs, avocado, paper towels, apples, lunch meat, and carrots, all scavenged from nearby dumpsters. Outraged citizens flooded the city council meetings. It was clear the dead bear had been drawn into town by the endless availability of human food. They pushed council members to pass an ordinance that would require Boulder residents to lock up their trash in bear-resistant garbage bins, specially designed containers with complex configurations to keep bears out. Though trash ordinances already existed in small mountain towns like Banff and those near Lake Tahoe, it was the first time a large city would pass such a law in the United States. That Boulder, a city with more than 100,000 residents, should need to implement this strategy to deal with black bears signaled a profound shift in the American West. As urban areas expanded, hungry black bears were no longer going to abide by arbitrary human boundaries. So began my ursine odyssey. Halfway into my master's program, I zeroed in on reporting on bear-human conflict around the Rocky Mountains. On crisp autumn weekends, I tagged along with Boulder's Community Fruit Rescue Initiative, as dozens of volunteers armed with clawed fruit pickers and wicker baskets traveled among North Boulder's backyards, stripping apple trees bare at the behest of homeowners. Their mission was to remove any food source that might entice a bear to abandon its woodland home and end up on the wrong side of a rifle. I also started hanging around with the Boulder Bear Sitters, a hodgepodge group of local citizens tasked with watching over bears sleeping in town, ensuring the Bruins could safely make it back into the mountains at night. Boulder wasn't the only place confronting an ursine insurgency. Across the American West, black bears were moving into towns and cities, and grizzlies were expanding their range. In Aspen, Colorado, I accompanied enforcement officers patrolling the town for free-flowing garbage. Aspen was nearly overrun with meddlesome bears. "Bears are all I do," one officer told me, as he inspected a tipped-over garbage bin that had been secured with a piece of string. "Bears in trash, bears in garages, bears in cars, bears in houses." An off-duty cop had even been attacked while walking through a trash-infused alley one recent summer night. Aspen led to Banff, Alberta, where the Providence's grizzly population was recovering following the end of a trophy hunt 8 years prior and moving east into the foothills. And I followed the spine of the Rockies down to Yellowstone, where I met with ranchers worried about their own booming grizzly population. The population in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem had more than doubled since the bears were first protected under the Endangered Species Act in 1975. Now the bears were wandering out of the national park and getting into cattle and sheep herds. Conflicts were surging in the wake of such ursine expansion. As I had discovered in Boulder, people weren't exactly sure how to coexist with bears living next door. In New Jersey, where the black bear population had grown by a factor of 30 in just 5 decades, in 2014, a black bear chased and killed a hiker, the first documented fatality in the state's history. In Sierra Madre, California, near Angeles National Forest, a young woman was attacked by a black bear while napping in a backyard hammock. She escaped by hitting the bear on the face with her laptop. Meanwhile, grizzly attacks in the Rocky Mountain West have ballooned. In the summer of 2020, a mountain biker riding near Big Sky, Montana, was severely mauled by a bear. Too mangled to speak, he tried to explain what had befallen him by scribbling "bear" in the gravel where he collapsed. Near Yellowstone's Old Faithful Geyser, a woman was attacked when she encountered a grizzly sow and cub. 5 others in the Yellowstone area had been attacked by July of that year, obliterating past records. While most attacks in previous years had occurred on elk hunters in the late fall, most of the 2020 incidents involved other outdoor recreationists, joggers, hikers, cyclists. It seemed our relationship with bears were nearing a tipping point. The Rockies eventually led me to more distinct ranges, I hiked through the Min Mountains of China, home to many of the world's remaining wild pandas. I traveled the Andes in search of South America's only surviving bear species. And I encountered feeding sloth bears in India's Aravalli Hills. But overwhelmingly, I encountered bears behind bars. Pandas in captive breeding centers, caged moon bears on biofarms, and rescued dancing sloth bears. Those species I was fortunate enough to see apart from such manufactured landscapes were often living on the fragmented edges of wilderness. At the top of the world, polar bears are spending more time ashore as climate change melts their sea ice habitat. Scientists told me they expect almost all of the world's polar bear populations to crash before the end of this century. Some bear species I never witnessed roaming free. My journey would ultimately yield an unromanticized view of bears' tenuous position in the Anthropocene. Though the conservation challenges ahead are many, I was often struck by the leniency and grace extended toward the bears I encountered, particularly when compared with other predators. Though state wildlife agencies in North America are tasked with killing so-called problem bears, many people strive to prevent such needless death. I have never heard of any wolf or mountain lion sitters. The gruff men with leathered hands and burnished Stetsons I met in Montana would never abide wolves or coyotes. A howl on the breeze had them reaching for their gun. But bears were another matter. The distinction puzzled me. Why were bears put in a different class from the other predators on the landscape? Perhaps it was because of our own social constructions. The first animal form we encounter in this world is often a bear, a crib-side companion that accompanies us in our formative years. Later, in childhood, parents read bedtime stories featuring bears as fairy tale heroes. Winnie the Pooh, the Berenstain Bears, Rupert Bear, Paddington Bear. By imbuing bears with a whimsical nature during infancy, had we unwittingly crafted a complicated relationship with the species? Consider the fairy tale antagonists. The big bad wolf reigns supreme in Red Riding Hood and The Three Little Pigs. But I've yet to encounter a tale featuring a villainous bear, though brown bears likely still roamed Germany's Black Forest, the ground zero of fairy tales, when the brothers Grimm were spinning their most famous yarns. In Goldilocks and the Three Bears, arguably the most notable piece of bear folklore, our ire is not directed toward the bear family, but rather the intrusive human. Robert Southey, the English poet who wrote the first printed version in 1837, describes three bachelor bears, a little small wee bear, a middle-sized bear, and a great huge bear, as good-natured, trusting, harmless, and hospitable, as polite as bears can be. In contrast, Goldilocks is characterized as impudent, foul-mouthed, ugly, and dirty. Initially, he wrote her as a silver-haired old woman. Later iterations would transform her into a blonde damsel or child. This triumvirate of friendly bears is the unwitting victim of a narcissistic human who breaks into their home, eats their porridge, and splinters wee bear's beloved chair. Then, when all is said and done, she passes out in their bed. Our modern reality does not differ much from this fabled world. We have entered the bear's home without permission and selfishly laid claim to what we found there. In the words of Wee Bear, someone's been lying in my bed. And, well, here we are. Introduction. The family of animals known as Ursidae was once considered to be among our closest relatives. Indigenous stories and myths of antiquity spoke of an animal with profound similarities to our own kind, a being that shared the same core and thereby our journey through this world, or a shapeshifter switching seamlessly between human and beast. These perceptions live on in dances and legends wherein the bear serves as mother, protector, teacher, and Medicine Man. Along the western coast of North America, First Nations share the same estuaries with grizzlies and black bears, moving synchronously between sea and shore. Elders say that if a person ever becomes lost in the forest, to survive they should eat everything a bear does: salmon, berries, silverweed, chocolate lily, northern rice root, everything except the toxic skunk cabbage. Peruvian farmers tell stories of a bear man who travels the Andes and steals away young women. In Scandinavia, Laplanders speak of the old man with the fur garment. The Yakuts of the Russian Far East refer to neighboring brown bears as grandfather and uncle. Stories of a familial bear exist in almost every human culture that shares territory with the animal. But why? The likely reason is that bears resemble and behave like people. Few living mammals are able to move on their hind legs. Primates, rodents, pangolins, kangaroos, and bears, which are scientifically dubbed occasional bipeds, are the exceptions. When skinned, a bear's pale, gleaming carcass exhibits a disturbing resemblance to the human body. William of Auvergne, a medical theologian, observed that bear meat also tastes considerably like human flesh, raising the unappetizing question of how he was able to draw such comparison. A bear's footprint, equivalent to a man's size 11 shoe, appears in the soil much like our own five-toed impression. Shepherds in the French Pyrenees called the brown bear la va-nu-pied, the barefooted one. Even American conservationist John Muir was known to wax poetic about our ursine doppelganger. "Bears are made of the same dust as we," he wrote. "They breathe the same winds and drink of the same waters." This likeness was not lost on the Greek philosopher Aristotle either, who made note of the bear's erect posture, single stomach, and five claws with three joints in his History of Animals, written in the 4th century BCE. In one Greek myth, the nymph Callisto strolls through the forest and swears to the goddess Artemis that she will remain a virgin. When such a promise proves hard to keep in Zeus's presence, Artemis transforms Callisto into a bear as punishment for her unchastity. Callisto's son Arcas later hunts his mother, not recognizing the bear as his own flesh and blood. Zeus intervenes, sending Callisto and her son to live on among the burning stars as Ursa Major and Ursa Minor. The belief that humans and bears were of close relation, underlined by the writings of Aristotle and Pliny the Elder, persisted until the Middle Ages. Three animals were then considered to be our wild siblings: the monkey, the pig, and the bear. The monkey because it appeared to imitate human behavior and expression. The pig because, when dissected by medical students, it was found to mirror our own anatomical composition. However, the Christian Church considered these two comparisons unsavory. By simulating our actions, the monkey proved itself a dirty trickster. It was a demonic creature. The pig, gluttonous and lazy, was similarly relegated to the devil's bestiary. This is why, although doctors knew that the pig was anatomically a cousin to man, wrote medieval historian Michel Pastoureau in The Bear, History of a Fallen King, the Christian Church did not declare the fact too openly and allowed clerics to assert that the animal that most resembled humans was neither the pig nor the monkey, but the bear. Yet this did not stop people from subjecting the bear to cruel spectacle in a boorish attempt to dethrone the animal. Paleontology and the advent of genetic analysis would eventually disprove any true relation. The march of progress began not with a bear, but with a common ancestor of human and ape. The bear lineage diverged around 30 million years ago, when global changes in the environment spurred a compendium of carnivores to split off from a group of slinky mammals with sharp teeth known as Miacidae that resembled today's civets or martens. The Miacidae served as the primitive precursor for the world's modern meat-eaters, giving rise to modern seals, Science suggests that this is the bear family's closest living relative. Wolverines, dogs, and bears. There were even bear dogs before man's would-be best friend went extinct. The oldest known bear genus, Ursivus, emerged around 20 million years ago, and, according to fossils dug up in Colorado and China, were roughly the size of a sheepdog. As such, the earliest bears are older than humans by an order of magnitude. The first human ancestor only appeared around 7 million years ago. Early bear species looked little like the animals we know today. Over the years, some extinct species have been unearthed or identified. Ursivus elmensis, the dawn bear, is considered the first true bear species. It was stout and not much bigger than a cat, with a dog-like face and a long, fluffy tail that it used for balance when it hunted from trees. Most of the modern bear lineages appeared in just the last 5 million years, extremely recently in terms of geological time. At the end of the Miocene, a minor extinction event caused most older bears, including Ursivus, to vanish. The world's modern bears evolved to fill the gaps left in the ecosystem. As jungles turned to dry forest, and dry forest to grassland, bears adapted their diets to thrive in new environments. The short-faced bear clade emerged on the plains. Agriotherium, which lived between 12 and 3 million years ago, was the only bear species to have ever roamed sub-Saharan Africa, with fossils unearthed in Ethiopia. Bears eventually spread from Africa and Eurasia into North America, and around 2.7 million years ago, after the continents connected, walked down to South America. Polar bears appeared on northern seacoasts around 500,000 years ago, making them the world's newest bear species. By the advent of the Holocene, bears could be found on nearly every corner of the planet. Around 25,000 years ago, many bear species began to go extinct. The cave bear, Ursus speleus, disappeared from Europe. What drove the animal to extinction continues to be a topic of contention in academic circles, with a cooling climate and conflicts with humans offered as the two warring explanations. The latter theory has gained ground in recent years. Even before the onset of the last glacial maximum, some 30,000 years ago, the genetic decline of cave bears had already begun. A 2019 study in Scientific Reports used genetic sequencing to reconstruct 59 complete cave bear mitochondrial genomes from 14 sites across Europe. The researchers found that cave bear populations began crashing around 40,000 years ago, coinciding with the spread of modern humans in Europe, not the spread of ice and snow. Neanderthals and modern humans were known to compete with cave bears for shelter, as well as hunt the animals. Accordingly, the cave bear is likely the first bear species humans managed to push to extinction. Arctotherium angustitans, a Honda Civic-sized giant short-faced bear that lived in South America, similarly did not make it out of the Pleistocene. At the time, it was likely the largest carnivorous land mammal on the continent and could top running speeds of 45 miles per hour. Most other species in the short-faced bear clade vanished during a period known as the Quaternary extinction, when more than 30 species of large American mammals, horses, mammoths, giant beavers, and musk oxen disappeared. Were humans to blame again? The Clovis people who inhabited North America at the time have largely been exonerated from triggering the demise of ancient bears. Paleontologists have never turned up any evidence to suggest the Clovis hunted short-faced bears. However, the Clovis did hunt other large mammals, leaving behind sharp stone spear points at sites across the Americas. It's possible that the Clovis appetite for herbivorous prey, combined with the changing climate, proved extinguishing for the bears. Modern ursids are now exceedingly rare. There are 35 species of canines, from wolves to dholes, jackals to foxes. Felines number 41, cetaceans, whales, porpoises, dolphins, are abundant with more than 90 species. And there are as many as 500 species of primates. Bears don't even enter the double digits. Today, we are left with just 8 species of bears. Some are celebrated as icons of the natural world. The brown bear, Ursus arctus. The American black bear, Ursus americanus. The panda bear, Ailuropoda melanoloica. And the polar bear, Ursus maritimus. The others are lesser known. The Asiatic black bear, Ursus thibetanus. The sun bear, Halarctus malianus. The sloth bear, Molursus ursinus. And the spectacled bear, Trimarctos ornatus. Charismatic and unloved alike, these 8 bears are all that remain of a family that has been our steadfast companion since time immemorial, shaping our cultures, our geographies, and our stories. All of the world's living bears belong to the Ursidae family, which accommodates the subfamilies of Ursini, Trimarctini, and Ailuropodini. In the Ursini subfamily, we find what biologists consider the modern bears, the polar bear, brown bear, American black bear, Asiatic black bear, sloth bear, and sun bear. The cave bears were part of this group too, before our ancestors wiped out the species. In the Trimarctini subfamily, which once housed the short-faced bear clad, we're now left with just the speckled bear of the Andes. Similarly, the giant panda is the sole living member of the Ailuropodini and belongs to the oldest bear lineage, diverging 19 million years ago from Ursivus, the ancestral genus of the Ursidae family. Ailuropoda micrida, the panda's ancestor, was alive around 2 million years ago, and according to scientific reconstruction, appeared much like the modern panda, but smaller at 3 feet long instead of 5. Beyond this, the panda's anatomy has hardly changed over millennia. Pandas have been uniquely pandas for many millions of years, Russell Siochan, a paleoanthropologist, told the New York Times in 2007, following the discovery of this pygmy ancestor's skull in southern China. Naively, many people refuse to believe the list stops at just 8. They point to the koala or the red panda in their rebuttals. The koala bear, the most famous of the not-a-bears, earned its misleading title because when Europeans arrived in Australia, they believed the tiny eucalyptus-dwelling creature was part of the bear clan. In 1816, the marsupial was given the Latin name Phascolarctos cinereus, meaning ash-gray pouched bear. In actuality, the wombat is the koala's closest relative. Similarly, the Australian drop bear is also a not a bear, nor an animal at all. This fictitious creature, Thalarctos plummetus, is nothing more than a hoax designed to scare American tourists. Pandas are bears, despite what some think, but red pandas are not. The Chinese red panda and Himalayan red panda, recently discovered to be 2 distinct species, are the only living members of the family Ailuridae. Apart from their eye patches, they have little in common with the giant panda. Lastly, there is the water bear. These minute tardigrades, 8-legged micro-animals named for their bear-like gait, are extraordinarily resilient animals, able to survive from the deep sea to mud volcanoes to outer space. Alas, they are also not a bears. Still, the 8 true species are remarkable in their own right. They inhabit 4 continents and a wide range of environments. They can be found in the cloud forest of the Andes and the bamboo forest of Asia, in the scrubland of India, in the sheep-dotted Pyrenees.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?